Muscle, the podcast is starting. Hello and welcome to Pod Trivia. So tell us, a Harry Potter read-along podcast. I am one of your hosts, Joe.
And I'm Cassie.
And today we're going to be reading, or we're going to be looking at the last chapter of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, which is chapter 18, Dobby's Reward.
Yes, we are. But first, let us introduce our guest, a very, very special guest, my sister, Becca.
You know her from one of three people who sent us emails.
There's more than three. But yes, Becca is a regular emailer, often about the economics of the wizarding world, which do not make any sense.
Yeah.
Yes. So thank you for joining us, Becca.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited. So the way that we always start this out with our guests is by getting to know them and their history with the Harry Potter series. This might be a little odd because I imagine your history is going to be a little intertwined with my history with the Harry Potter series, as we did grow up in the same household. But yeah, tell us about your history with the Harry Potter series, how you got into it, and sort of your relationship with it.
So I remember getting the first book from, like, I don't know, mom just brought it home one day and,
she probably stole it.
Maybe. I don't know. That's possible. But
it wasn't a library book.
It could have been. I don't think it was. I don't know where it came from, but, I do remember not reading it. And when the movie came out, I told you, Cassie, that I had read it, and I started giving you not spoilers, but like I'd warn you, like when Hagrid was coming, like, oh, he's a little scary. But like I hadn't actually read it. I was just like guessing and hoping that I would be right. But I totally lied and told you that I read it and I hadn't.
What a good trick.
Yeah.
I mean, I was probably six at the time. It came out in what, 01? Yeah, I would have been six or seven. So that's fine. It's surprising to me that you said that we had the book. I don't remember that at all. I remember we started reading them, or I and our other siblings started reading them after the movie. But I had no idea we had that first book.
I think we did. It was just like lying around. Like,
okay.
You might have just been too young.
Yeah, I was too young and dumb to notice. So then that's, I guess, the initial interest of the series. So how did it grow from there, or not grow?
Well, I remember, I have a memory of actually reading all the books, but I don't retain the things I read very well. So I don't really remember the books that well. But I do remember watching the movies when they came out. Like, religiously.
We definitely went to a lot of premieres.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that one specifically. I'm not sure which movie it was. I want to say it was Half-Blood Prince, when that woman walked down the aisle of the movie theater in a Lucius Malfoy costume with the cane in her hand.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
It was a real dedication to that, like, 12 p.m. matinee of Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so I remember you specifically reading the large text version of Goblet of Fire.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, I remember it because Goblet of Fire already is a huge book. And then when you magnify that text,
it's just easier to read. I don't know why. No, that's fine. But it is.
That's absolutely fine. You don't have to defend that. And there is a very special memory, too, that we haven't really gotten into on the podcast, of reading the last book.
Oh my God. You'll never let me live this down ever.
The book came out, obviously, and everybody was raring to know what happened. And we only would buy one copy between the three of us, because why would you buy three copies of these books? And so the compromise was to have me and Becca switch off reading chapters aloud of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows to each other. I don't remember at which point in the book that fell apart, but towards the end, it was definitely just me reading them.
Oops.
Yeah, but I like the idea that you are more of a reluctant fan, if you don't mind me editorializing that?
Sure.
To the series, because we have had super fans on so far.
Yeah.
So I think you might be more posed to do critical reading of the series.
Yeah, I think so.
So if you had to pick one, which is your favorite Harry Potter book or movie, if you feel more familiar with those?
I feel like I remember Goblet of Fire being my favorite book because it's just like a lot of fun. But movie wise, Chamber of Secrets, because it's so goofy. And I love Kenneth Branagh. That's how you pronounce it, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
He's so good in that movie. And I also, we recently watched Order of Phoenix, and it was actually pretty action-packed, and like, it really like keeps your attention more so than I remember. So I actually did like that movie a lot, but definitely Chamber of Secrets movie is my favorite.
Okay. I do love Goblet of Fire. There's so much good stuff in there. It starts with a real big event. I don't want to talk about it in too much specificity. There's so much going on and so much fun packed in there. So I definitely agree on that one. The Chamber of Secrets movie is phenomenal, I think, as well. It's
good.
Like, I have watched all the movies through a bunch of times with my friend, and sometimes we'll like skip the younger ones, but we did that a couple times in a row, and then I got him to like start from the beginning. He was like, oh, I forgot how good that Chamber of Secrets was, because it's such a solid movie and it's a solid book.
I definitely think it is.
I think there's a level of whimsy to the movie that isn't in the book, because as we've kind of discovered, the book is kind of dark. Like, a lot of spooky things happen in it, but the movie definitely leans into the more campy elements, I think.
And I love it.
Yeah, it's good. I'm surprised too to hear you say that about Order of the Phoenix, though, because that one, historically, fans have been deeply upset about because so much was dropped from it and it was condensed so much. But I find your action-packed comment interesting, because Order of the Phoenix is a long book.
Yeah.
And it's maybe not so action-packed.
I guess they just really cut out all the useless. I don't know. I don't remember the book that well.
You're
going to
upset a lot of people saying useless.
Oh my God. I don't remember the book that well. So
that's okay.
Don't at me.
Yeah. And then I want to ask, who do you think your favorite character or characters are in the Harry Potter series?
Well, I am biased because in the movies, McGonagall is played by Maggie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a front runner for favorite. Yeah, I guess McGonagall is my favorite.
Okay. I do like McGonagall. Yeah, Maggie Smith brings a lot. It's like the people that really like Snape, I have to imagine that part of that is informed by Alan Rickman playing him.
I think so.
Because he's a garbage person in otherwise.
The character, not Alan Rickman.
Oh, yeah. I don't know anything about Alan Rickman as well. He's not a person really anymore. He died.
He's not a person? Ouch. What is that supposed to mean?
Harsh. Whoa.
Yeah. So I'm excited to talk about this chapter with you, Becca.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Let's get into it. Okay. Let's dig in.
All right.
It is my turn to do the chapter summary. And listeners, I have a confession. I forgot to prepare one this time. So I'm going to go off the cuff here so you can compare and contrast with my chapter summary and Joe's chapter summaries. I did also read this chapter yesterday, so we'll see how hazy things are. But yes.
You've got a very solid memory of yesterday is a very long time ago.
Listen, things blur together. Joe seems to be getting a timer ready, and he's going to hit it when I start. Harry, Ron, Lockhart, and Ginny leave the Chamber of Secrets and go to Dumbledore's office. Dumbledore basically explains what happens to everybody lightly, and everybody gets dismissed gradually until it's just Harry and Dumbledore. Harry and Dumbledore talk about what it means to be a true Gryffindor and what happened in the chamber, and then Lucius Malfoy storms in, and he's all angry. Harry goes after Lucius Malfoy, who's here with Dobby as well, and Harry finds out a way to free Dobby, and then there's a feast, and everybody's happy.
All right. 28 seconds.
Okay. I think I hit the major lines.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I think so.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So we will talk about it in more specificity. The first thing I do want to bring up is something that we brought up in the last chapter of Harry did not like say that it was Voldemort who possessed Ginny in front of Ginny. And I think what we landed on was that he didn't want to upset Ginny further, that she was like really shaken up about what happened.
No, that was good call. That was what you were saying. My argument was that he didn't want to say in front of Ginny that Ginny was the one that did all the stuff.
Oh, okay.
To Ron.
That does sound familiar. Things just go in and out of my brain.
It only matters what you say.
I feel like I get stupider as I get older.
I can confirm that is something that happens because it's definitely happening to me.
I feel like I hit a peak at one point and then it went downhill. But okay, I like both explanations. I think they can coexist.
You're like bottom is like my peak. So don't even like feel bad.
But we did also talk about last week that we weren't sure when someone actually tells Ginny.
Right.
And we do. Dumbledore says it right now.
Yes, that's what I wanted to return to. And Dumbledore also absolves Ginny of any kind of responsibility. He says
right away.
Yeah, he says like people much smarter, much older, or maybe not much smarter, but like more experienced wizards have fallen for Voldemort much more easily than Ginny did. So he doesn't lay any blame at Ginny's feet,
which is good.
Yeah. And he like right out of the gate, he does that, which is very nice.
Yeah. And the Weasley parents are there. Molly is definitely there. Arthur, I have to imagine, is there?
Yes, they're both written in.
Okay. I didn't remember.
Like they both were there.
Okay.
Mrs. Weasley is the one that yells Ginny.
Yeah.
But Mr. Weasley is right behind her.
Okay. And they're there. And so I think that's important that Dumbledore does that. I do wonder if the school at large learned that Ginny was involved in these events other than being taken to the chamber.
I feel like they might not have made that the most public.
Yeah. I feel like that might create some ill will.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but it makes sense.
Yeah. And there was also something that I saw in Gladriel that she was questioning whether any of the students who were petrified had seen Ginny in that moment. But it's the basilisk doing the petrification.
Yeah, Ginny wasn't like walking around with the basilisk on a leash.
Yeah. So I think Gladriel was wrong again. Yes, but I do think that's important that Dumbledore just completely, not even forgives Ginny, just doesn't blame her in the slightest.
Yeah, no forgiveness necessary.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's important. Dumbledore does also mention that Voldemort is hiding in Albania. I do wonder where this intel came from. I wasn't able to find anything surrounding that. But I did find a little bit of an interesting thing that the word Albania can, of course, refer to the actual country Albania in Southeast Europe. But the medieval Latin term Albania apparently refers to Scotland, which is where Hogwarts is located. And I thought
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either until I read it on the Harry Potter wiki. the former makes more sense that Voldemort is hiding far away from like where the magical community seems to be centered, at least that we think to this point in the books. But I think it's interesting that this intel could work both ways, that if somebody said, oh, I got a tip that he's in Albania, Dumbledore might take that as, oh, he's in Southeast Europe, whereas they could have been using that antiquated term and Voldemort is a much closer threat than they had anticipated.
Yeah, potentially.
I don't know. I feel like they're probably just referring to Albania.
They probably are. Yeah. I just liked the idea that it could work on both levels and it could be like, oh no, I was mistaken. And now Voldemort has attacked.
Yikes.
Yeah. So that I found interesting.
I mean, actually, though, it would make kind of sense because they're so willfully antiquated, which is something I wanted to bring up later.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I actually think that's something I wanted to bring up as well. And I think we can segue into it because Molly says, never trust anything that can think for itself if you can't see where it keeps its brain. And I think this is good advice to live by, at least in the wizarding world.
Yeah.
But I think it explains some of the technophobia in the wizarding world, that if this is something that is like common wizard knowledge, you know, like a saying that parents say to their children a lot, I think it would explain why they wouldn't use computers.
I wouldn't say a computer necessarily can think for itself.
Yeah.
It has but it just has a storage of information, can access information.
Right. But like the diary has a storage of Tom Riddle's memories that it's accessing. Yes, Tom Riddle does seem to have a level of free will,
which means it's thinking for itself.
All right. So I guess that's the line between an artificial intelligence and a regular computer. Let's see what else happens in this
Liked very early on, before Dumbledore even says anything, when Fox sees Dumbledore, it's so excited to see him and like flies over, like pushes past Harry and jumps on his shoulder. I have no idea how big Fox is. It fits on his shoulder.
I assume pretty big. Wait, it fits on his shoulder. Okay, you're saying you thought it would be too big. I don't know. In the movie, it's pretty big, but like not so big that it wouldn't fit on a shoulder.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Slightly larger than a standard parrot.
Smaller feet. Like, it doesn't have to.
Why small feet? Where does that?
Small enough to fit on a shoulder.
Oh, okay. Okay. But like shoulders are pretty big. You could fit a pretty big bird on your shoulder.
I guess. Yeah.
Because like Fox is a tall bird.
Where's this information coming
from?
The
movie.
That's a tall bird.
Yeah, I think Fox is tall.
Okay.
What were you going to say, Becca?
I feel uncomfortable saying it now. I was going to say he's a tall drink of water, but I wouldn't say that about a bird.
That's why it's funny.
Okay.
It is cute that Fox is so excited to see Dumbledore.
It is.
I know you like pets, so.
I do like pets, but it also it reinforces the loyalty to Dumbledore. And then Dumbledore goes and talks to Harry after he lets everyone else go. And thanks him for being so loyal and saying that's the only reason Fox showed up.
Yeah, yeah. And we can assume that's when Harry, and I think this lines up in the timeline of the last chapter when Harry says, like, you're not the greatest wizard to ever live. That's Dumbledore.
Yes.
And I think that's the inciting moment. I do have to wonder how Fox knew to bring the sorting hat. Because Dumbledore wasn't there.
Dumbledore wasn't there, but Dumbledore comes in knowing a lot more
Where's Dumbledore should have
for, like, if he was just filled in by the kids, that's one thing. But he comes in knowing a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like he just lets them tell their story rather than explaining everything himself.
Yeah.
So I would believe that Dumbledore was like, hey, Fox, here's the sorting hat. If anyone needs it, specifically the one that we know is going to go poking around in in the Chamber of Secrets.
Yeah, that's interesting, because also I think there's a mirror here happening to the last chapter of the first book. It's very similar that like all this bad stuff happens and then Harry and Dumbledore have this like one-on-one conversation about it all and kind of go through what happened. And both times Dumbledore seems to know more than he should. And I think
it's just weird.
It is weird. And in the first book, I think it's assumed that because Dumbledore was the one to rescue Harry from the like dungeon that they were in. I don't know exactly where all of this happened after they went through the trapdoor, but Dumbledore was the one to rescue Harry. So I can assume that he could put together what happened from seeing everything. But mm-hmm. he hasn't even been in the school for the last couple days.
I'm sure he was still keeping tabs on things. Sure. He wasn't in Azkaban like Hagrid. Yeah.
He's got those security cameras posted up all through the school.
He's got Fox keeping watch. Oh,
that's a good point. Maybe Fox told him.
Plus all the portraits maybe he's got.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I like that one. I like that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. But it definitely does raise questions about like how much did Dumbledore know about what was going on?
I feel like there was a lot of things he put together with
in that moment.
Yeah.
Because like when Harry shows him the diary, he's like, oh, yeah.
Because Dumbledore, while he probably knew a lot, I don't think he would have let this continue if he knew a way to solve the problem. If he knew,
this is where the Chamber
of Secrets is, and this is the student being controlled by Lord Voldemort. He obviously didn't know that much.
Right, yeah. I kind of took this conversation as he had a lot of pieces that with the explanations that Harry and Ron and Ginny are giving, the pieces are starting to fit together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Because also there is a whole scene, too, when they first walk into the office of just like Harry just tells them everything. He tells them about the voices. He tells them about all of these like coincidences that have happened throughout the book. Yeah. So let's see what else happens in this conversation. Dumbledore awards 200 house points to Ron and Harry.
Each.
Each.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a very easy way to say like, hey, we haven't talked at all about the House Cup, but guess who's still going to win?
And also, saving the world from Voldemort last time was worth like 50 and 60 each. This time they get 200.
But they saved a person.
Yeah, and they defeated a basilisk.
Yeah,
and they
a basilisk Voldemort. Corpse is in the Chamber of Secrets, which is now found.
Yeah,
thanks to
yeah.
these two students.
But like, also, Ron got 50 points last time for playing chess. This time he got 200 for moving some rocks.
And for conveniently having a broken wand.
Oh, yeah, true. Definitely got to give him points for that.
Yeah.
Or maybe give him money so he can buy a new wand.
But like, that thinking of all nice. The stuff that he did to help them get there.
Yes, of course. I'm not saying Ron is useless or anything, but 200 points. And to leave Hermione out of it, too, when she's the one that figured everything out.
She's petrified.
Yeah.
Also, 600 points, like 400 is a lot.
400 is a lot.
Is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. It's just, again, another big like, hey, I know you kids have been working hard all year to win the House Cup and you've been
too bad.
Doing the best. But Harry and Ron.
Also, how much was Gryffindor losing by?
I know that they needed 400 points to get in
that,
the lead.
Or they didn't need it. And they're just like, oh, and now we're 300 points in the lead.
Jeez.
It's crazy. It really, my eyes bugged out when I saw that. I'm like, 200 each. God.
Yeah, I think I had a similar reaction. Yeah.
What did they get? 10 total points
for the troll.
For the troll.
Was it 10 each, I think?
It was. I feel like
it was
Hermione
a very low amount.
Hermione lost points.
Some, yeah.
I think it worked out to like 10 points.
Net 10. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is so many. And that time they saved a person, too. They saved Hermione from the troll.
But they were instructed to be. Well, actually, in this situation, they were also instructed to be in their common rooms.
Yeah, they really were. It's wild. It is a wild number of house
Voldemort
points to award.
Voldemort wasn't involved with the troll.
And also,
actually, Voldemort like, was what? Involved with the troll.
Like, I'm just wondering, like, what is the purpose of the House Cup? Like, why? Like, it doesn't seem like friendly competition between the students, because they're already kind of, especially all the students against Slytherin, they're all kind of pitted against each other already. Like, why keep that up? Like, why encourage that?
It's a positive reinforcement system. And this might be getting a little deep into educational psychology, but it's not that complicated of a concept. It's basically trying to give an incentive for good behavior and de-incentivize bad behavior by awarding and taking away points, obviously. There are schools that have tried to adapt this model under something called the Ron Clark Academy, which basically just takes the Harry Potter houses and gives
them
a different
name. Yeah,
the guy
who made it really likes Harry Potter.
Yeah, and it is... It does much of the same thing to the point where like teachers have an app where they can award points to students according to the students' houses for good things that they do in the school. I do believe I haven't studied it in too much detail, but I don't think they so much take away house points for bad behavior in the Ron Clark Academy. And the hope is that not only will it encourage good behavior between students, but it will also form a kind of camaraderie between team members. And they'll do things like, oh, sit with somebody in your team that you don't know this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so like for, say, a high school when you've got like 9th graders and 12th graders, there's usually pretty big social barriers between those age groups. And so if you're on the same team, like if you're both in Ravenclaw, ideally that will, you know, encourage you to mix a little bit more. And even within your grade to avoid like social groups forming, they give you kind of a social group. I think we see that benefit in the books that like there are Gryffindors who are just close to each other kind of by advent of just being Gryffindors, and they all vote. They all root for the Gryffindor team, and they have that house pride. The unfortunate side effect is, though, that it pits the students against each other.
Yeah.
And additionally, just like for convenient plot reasons, oh, the Gryffindors are the heroes for everyone. But
yeah.
Slytherin.
And the Slytherin is the evil house.
Like, oh, the Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw. Kids are always so excited to see Gryffindor win.
Yeah.
Because at least it's not Slytherin. Slytherin.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I think that the system itself is maybe not necessarily bad. I think the way that Hogwarts allows it to play out is a problem.
Dumbledore specifically, for the sake of convenient, like, Gryffindor wins.
Yeah, there's some favoritism happening there. And I think that the teachers, to an extent, encourage them to be pitted against each other. Like, Snape is head of Slytherin House and treats all of the Gryffindors like trash. So that signals to the Slytherin students, it's okay to treat Gryffindors like trash because they're another house.
Gryffindors are trash. No, just kidding. Sorry.
You're going to upset some people about that.
I'm just kidding.
No, but like, it is true. And with the Gryffindors like stealing this victory from the Slytherins, especially in that first book, that encourages ill will. Like, that allows the Gryffindors to strut around like, we're the best. We can do no wrong. Dumbledore will come save us at the end of the year with a 400 point windfall. I mean,
mind you, before then, it was like 7 years in a row that Slytherin had been winning. Sure. So it's not like Dumbledore was always doing this.
Yeah.
But he really likes Harry Potter.
Yeah. But in the way that, like, you're saying, like, Dumbledore really likes Harry Potter, it's, I don't think they ever actually say it, but I always got the sense that, like, the reason Slytherin was always winning was because, like, Snape favored them so much and, like, somehow, like, or they use, like, I feel like it's implied that they use, like, dirty tricks or something, and that's why they always win.
I got that sense, too.
I don't remember where I was going with this.
No, yeah. I get that sense, too, because if Snape is... I think that we can assume that all of the other teachers, while they may have their partiality, are fairly unbiased in their point awarding.
Yeah.
Except for Snape. He takes points from Gryffindor for basically anything. And so I think that will specifically sink Gryffindors. And he also awards points to Slytherins for basically nothing. I got the sense that he was very much kind of putting a finger on the scales there.
But also, I feel like the Quidditch games hold a very high
but Charlie won the Quidditch Cup when he was there.
How many years ago?
Oh, we talked about this math last time about Bill.
Was it 7 years ago?
Maybe. Okay.
Was it the 7 years
let's
before?
Say that it was 7 years.
Okay. Yeah. There are, I'm sure, a lot of factors. I think we can also assume, too, that Slytherins, like Becca said, are kind of doing dirty tricks to maybe, like, put the blame on somebody else for the trouble that they cause and that sort of thing.
But we don't know for sure. We're just entirely speculating.
Yeah, we'll have to wait for that prequel.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
No, you don't have to wait for a prequel. You just have to wait for a tweet.
Oh, I don't want to read any more tweets.
Good idea.
Yeah. Let's see what else. Dumbledore, when it's just him and Harry talking about it, he does say that Voldemort transferred some of his powers to Harry when he tried to kill him. And this is how Harry knows Parseltongue. Again, this is something that we can't talk about fully in context, but put that in your thinking hat and save it for...
I mean, it's a crazy thing for Dumbledore to just know.
And just to, like, say.
Yeah, he's, like, casually revealing
this. Hey, you got a bit of the Dark Lord inside of you, Harry.
You have some of his power. He has no power because you have some of it.
Yeah. But it's an interesting concept that I do wonder what is... And I know the answer is it's magic. I do wonder what the mechanism is through which some of that power... transferred to Harry. And I do wonder also what the mechanism is for Voldemort to control Ginny through the diary.
That part I'm very curious about.
Yeah.
The way that Tom Riddle describes it in the last chapter, it seems like as she kept giving him her secrets, he was getting more powerful and she was just getting weaker.
Yeah.
So I guess it almost seems like he was possessing her.
Right. And we do learn later on about a spell that will allow people to control other people. But I don't think that this is what has happened. And again, it's magic. Like, we can explain away most of the plot holes in this series by just like, well, it's magic. But it is interesting to think about. Yeah, so I did want to raise that. And I think this is also something that we'll learn about more later on. Let's see. Yeah. Dumbledore says... not as famous line as the one in the last book, it does not do to dwell on dreams. But I think this one is also very good and very Dumbledore. He says, it is our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are far more than our abilities. This is obviously rolling speaking through Dumbledore. She does usually, especially with lines with these, speak through Dumbledore and try to like impart some kind of wisdom on the reader. But I think it's also an important ethos for this series that we have a choice in our actions and who we want to be, and we can choose to do good, even if we've made bad choices in the past.
Or bad things have happened to us.
Yes, absolutely. And if we're not the most, let's say, powerful or learned wizard, because like, let's call back to Neville in the first book, that Neville's not the best at magic, let's say. He's maybe not the brightest kid, but he chooses to stand up to Harry, Ron, and Hermione. So regardless of his abilities, he makes that choice to do what he believes is right.
Yeah, it's a good thing to tell kids. It's a good message for kids.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it reflects, too, in the whole ordeal with Harry and the Sorting Hat, which we have to talk about, that it's something that's been bothering him this whole time of, like, was I meant to be in Slytherin? Am I supposed to be in Slytherin? Am I worthy of Gryffindor? And it comes down to that choice.
Yes. And then it is reinforced by, like, and more than just your thoughts, here's the sword that you couldn't have pulled out if you weren't a true Gryffindor.
But that, I feel like, undercuts it a little bit. What is it that makes Harry a true Gryffindor?
Being in Gryffindor.
Being brave. Isn't it being brave?
Yeah.
Is that a choice that Harry makes? Or is it an ability, is it just like an innate part of himself? I guess a little bit of both.
It's the choice to act on that.
Okay.
You can say, I want to do what's right, but being able to actually act on it and do it, it takes bravery.
I feel like it might also be like, I'm going to try not to use spoilers, but like, I feel like because later in the series, we learn certain spells require you to like have an intention or like a memory in mind.
Okay. Yeah.
When you use them, like maybe that's like, goes along with how he was able to be a true Gryffindor. Like Joe was saying, that it's not being a Gryffindor, it's the choice to act on your bravery and stuff.
Okay, yeah.
I don't think I'm making any sense.
No, I think that does make sense, because that allows for, everyone can be brave. But when you're put in a moment of pressure, what sort of instinct do you fall back on? And I think that that might be a defining quality of the Gryffindors, that they fall back on bravery, and the Ravenclaws fall back on their cleverness and their wit and that sort of thing. I think that is a good idea, because I think it adds a little nuance too, of allowing for like, well, Slytherins, they're not brave and they're not honorable in all of these Gryffindor qualities. It's just the way that they choose to act in these situations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that. So I thought that was a good line. And it does kind of wrap up this whole conflict that Harry has been having, because Dumbledore, they do talk about that moment. Harry says, like, I have to confess this, that the hat didn't want to put me in Gryffindor. It wanted me to be in Slytherin, and I asked it not to. And Dumbledore is like, that's the key, Harry. You asked it not to. That's what makes you a Gryffindor.
You chose not to be in Slytherin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, again, I think it's a good message for kids.
How different would this book be
if he Harry didn't, was in Slytherin?
If he didn't conveniently see how horrible Malfoy was in that robe shop.
That is true, that I think part of him rejecting Slytherin was seeing what Malfoy was, but I think it was also very much informed by Ron.
Well, he gets like warned by other people, but he sees it in I don't think that Harry's the type of person to be like, well, somebody told me I should guess. Hate this
yeah,
person.
Yeah, that's true.
So if he hadn't seen that firsthand before anything happened.
Didn't Hagrid talk some mess about Slytherin early in the first book? Yeah, I feel
talked some mess right around the time that Malfoy sees.
Okay.
Or that Harry sees Malfoy.
Malfoy in the shop, yeah. Yeah.
But I do want to go back a little bit to a different quote from Dumbledore.
Sure.
Where he says, I seem to remember telling you both that I would have to expel you if you broke any more rules. And then he says, which goes to show that the best of us must sometimes eat our words.
Yeah.
And I think that's really great. It's also like, it's a way to say, you know, what you did was dangerous.
Like, stop doing this, but like, it worked out again this time.
But also it's important for, you know, adults to admit they're wrong.
Yeah.
It's so important for kids to see that adults can be wrong and for them to admit it. Like, apologize when you do the wrong thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a powerful thing. And to like dig your heels in and say, no, I'm older, I'm right, is just so unhelpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. And I like that Dumbledore is willing to do that. I think that makes him a good headmaster, at least in this moment.
And of course, in his Dumbledore way, it's also a very fun little line. It's not just like, I'm sorry, but
yeah,
it's, I'm going to eat my words.
I like the idea too, that Dumbledore, he has this weird, he's humble. He definitely doesn't like buy into all of, we don't see him at least being like, yeah, I'm the best. Everybody thinks I'm the strongest and Voldemort's afraid of me.
I mean, but he did say the best of us.
He plays with it in an interesting way that's kind of fun. And I think that I prefer it to him being modest in that way. That's like, oh, I'm not the greatest. Like, I think that this is more true to, obviously, the character, but just like more true to, I don't know. He's
playing into Harry's thoughts, because
right.
Harry actively defends Dumbledore, saying he is the greatest wizard. And so he is saying, like, even the best of us, like, even if I don't think I'm the best, even the best of us can make mistakes.
Yeah. And I like to think that he is modeling things really well for the students in this way, that like, even I admit when I'm wrong. I admit when I make a mistake. Yeah. Yeah, I think that is a good moment. Dumbledore says that he needs to draft an advertisement for a new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher in the Daily Prophet. If this is how he's been finding his teachers, it's not a surprise that he hired Voldemort and a fraud.
I mean, they don't have Olas in the Wizarding World.
But like,
where?
Daily Prophet? I know. Where
we
else?
We don't currently have another magazine or any kind of news thing that the wizards are using.
Sure.
We get just the Daily Prophet.
But like, I like to think
he has a network. And you would advertise for jobs in a newspaper.
I like to think he has a network of professionals that he would consider for a position, but I guess
we already found out that Lockhart was picked because he's the only one that applied.
Yeah, I just, advertising for a professor job in the Daily Prophet just seems, that shocked me.
Yeah. Speaking of Lockhart, though, everyone forgets about Lockhart, including us. We move past this.
Yeah. He's just like kind of standing in the back making weird comments. And Dumbledore eventually is like, what about Professor Lockhart? And he's like, Professor, me?
Well, he's not even making weird comments. He said nothing so far. And Dumbledore says, why so modest? And Harry had completely forgotten about Lockhart as well.
Oh, my God.
They're really mean to him. Like, I know he's a scummy guy, but like, it seems like he has the mental state of a child in this moment.
Yeah. Yes, he absolutely does.
So just to like put him in a corner like this and just be like, oh, that guy.
He's still here.
That guy.
Well, it's almost saying like Lockhart wouldn't have been anything if he wasn't constantly pushing to be in the spotlight.
Yeah.
Like throughout this book, he's only mentioned because he keeps interrupting people. He keeps talking over people. Like he shows up. Oh, he's in the scene with Hagrid because he's trying to tell Hagrid how to do his job.
Yeah.
He's trying to tell Professor Sprout how to do her job.
I think the difference is in the past, he has been an aggressive and conniving fool. And now he's just a fool.
He is definitely a fool.
Poor guy.
Yeah, it does. I honestly feel a little bad for Lockhart.
I don't yet.
Yeah.
Fair. I don't know how I feel.
But Dumbledore, knowingly, after getting the explanation about what happened to him, knowingly says, impaled on your own sword, Gilderoy.
Yeah.
Like, you knew he was doing memory charms on people? What?
Just needed a warm body in that classroom.
Yeah, I need anyone. Anyone, Hogwarts? Please.
I was just going to say, maybe that's why he had to go to the Daily Prophet for an advertisement, because he exhausted his network, and the last time he tried to hire somebody, Gilderoy was the only one applied. So he's like, well, I better try something new.
Better widen that net.
to literally anyone.
All the qualified people don't want to do it. Yeah. So, yeah. Hogwarts really is a charter school. Let's see. Are we ready to talk about Lucius coming in?
Oh, yes. This kind of goes a little bit back to Lockhart also. I don't know. It goes back to everything.
Sure.
It's not like an issue I had with the chapter, but like I feel like everybody's just coming and going. Like,
that is true.
The Weasleys pop out at you the first scene of the chapter. And then it's like, you know what, guys? Ginny's got to go to the nursery. I mean, the infirmary. And so the Weasleys take her. And then Ron's hanging out. He's like, you know what, Ron, why don't you take Gilderoy Lockhart to the infirmary and then go to the feast? So they're gone. They're all just coming and going. And then Malfoy shows up. Yeah, I don't know. It's not like bad. It's just a little chaotic, I guess.
Dumbledore definitely does find convenient reasons to get everybody to leave the room so he can talk to Harry on his own.
Yeah.
He does so very intentionally.
Oh, yeah. We have to read it as intentional. I think that the Weasleys were probably in Dumbledore's office already.
Yeah, they started there, but
child might be dead.
He conveniently got rid of
them. Right, yes.
Yeah, it makes sense that they were there, but yeah, it's just like all these convenient comings and goings, like Joe said.
But
yeah.
I want to know how Lucius, got in the castle. Like,
he's one of the school governors.
Does that give him free reign to just come and go on the
school? Yeah, he already did before. He showed up just to get rid of Dumbledore, so he's going to show up and complain that Dumbledore is back.
Yeah, Dumbledore sticks it to him in this chapter, though. He's like, oh, well, you know, the attacks have stopped, so I'm back. And, you know, it's funny. I talked to the other governors, and they seem to be under the impression that you would curse them if they didn't they didn't vote for my removal.
He says, in such a
like a political non-confrontational
way of, someone was going to curse them. Curses would be put on their families.
Yeah.
Not like you would curse them.
That passive voice.
Yeah.
But Hagrid was right.
Yes.
In that moment, Hagrid was like, how many people did you threaten to get rid of Dumbledore here, Lucius? Turns out the rest of the school
All of
board.
Them.
Yeah, everyone.
Yeah. And I was a little shocked by this because how can Lucius stay respected in the wizarding community for this? I guess other people won't find out, but he is removed from the Board of Governors.
The Board of Ed, I feel like everyone who's on a Board of Ed is also has a second, an actual job.
Oh, yeah. That's not their full-time job.
Yeah. So,
Lucius doesn't have a job. His job is being rich.
No, Lucius is.
Yeah.
He works in the ministry.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's not losing any clout by not being involved in Hogwarts.
I guess, yeah.
And the people that really look up to him are the people who would not care that he did something wrong to Dumbledore.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It feels like this should be reported or something to the authorities.
Yeah, probably should. I guess they can't prove it, though, which Malfoy later says.
That's true.
And also, he'll just be like, I didn't get removed from the Board of Governors. I just didn't feel like doing it anymore. I have a lot of better things to do with my time.
I have to focus on my family. That's always what people say when they're in hot water for something. They're like, I need to take time to focus on my life and my family.
Yeah. And he clearly has the vibe, don't mess with
me. Yeah. And Draco Malfoy is kind of deflated by this. It says later on that, since Lucius was removed, he no longer walks around like he owns the place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited to see Draco not maybe staying in line, but towing the line a little bit more.
He's no longer immune.
Yeah. Yeah. It's no longer daddy will save me.
There's another point where Dumbledore does kind of get in his face a little bit. He says something about the Weasleys and how they're one of the most prominent pureblood families in Hogwarts, which people the Malfoy see them as these blood traitors. So hearing Dumbledore talk them up oh, they're this important pureblood family, basically saying, you're no different from them.
Yeah.
But he also does that to explain the plot that Malfoy had to, frame Ginny. So that if Ginny's off killing mudbloods and muggleborns, or I guess they're the same thing.
Yeah.
if Ginny's off opening the Chamber of Secrets, then that discredits the whole Weasley family.
Yeah, so it'd be shame if anybody found out that.
Yeah.
It would have ruined all his muggle protection rules and stuff that Malfoy has been actively upset with this whole book.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Lucius is a bad dude.
Yeah.
And Dumbledore kind of gives it to him in a very, like, subtle and polite way.
He's very polite this whole time.
Yeah. I mean, because he knows that Lucius has powerful connections and is a powerful dude. And, like, he's not going to start an out-out feud with Lucius here. But, like, the
But he's going to let Harry do
there.
It.
Oh, yeah. So speaking of, Lucius does walk in with Dobby. And this whole time, Dobby is, like, motioning to Harry and trying to give him, like, some kind of silent communication. And I hate when people do this. Like, when people try to mouth words to me or,
oh
like...
Oh, my God, me too.
Like, create hand signals. I'm always like, what?
Oh
what?
Although Dobby is being very obvious. Dobby is pointing at the diary, pointing at Malfoy. Point at diary, point at Lucius. Point at diary, point at Lucius.
Yeah, it's a little more clear, but I did think of that. So Dobby helps Harry put together that it was Lucius who gave Ginny the diary. There's that scene in Flourish and Blotts when Lucius like takes the book out of Ginny's cauldron and throws it back in. And Ginny says in this chapter that she found the diary shoved in, I think, her Transfiguration book. And that's how she got it. Mm-hmm. So Harry is able to put this all together with Dobby's help. And he asks Dumbledore as Lucius leaves the office if he can have the diary.
Yeah, if he can give it back.
I'm surprised that Dumbledore just let Harry have the diary.
He knew that Harry was planning something.
Right. Still.
And then he takes his sock off and this.
It's wet and slimy.
It's a wet, slimy sock. And then. So like in the movie, he puts it inside and like kind of. Yeah, we're going to have to talk about how
in
this
the book,
freeing
he
stuff
puts it
goes.
In the sock. He puts the diary in the sock. How big is this sock?
No, he doesn't put the diary in it. He just puts it on top.
Oh,
he just like
he?
Drapes the sock on top of the diary and hands it to him.
Oh, for some reason, I thought he put the diary in his sock.
Oh,
yeah. I was imagining it like, you know, the whole thing of like putting the quarters in your sock. That's how I was imagining it.
I gotta go.
You do you?
No, I'm sorry. Okay. That was just a joke about you referencing quarters in a sock. Sorry.
Okay, putting the sock on top of the diary is less bad. But like, how does Lucius just look at that and be like, I guess there's a sock here?
Well, he doesn't. He immediately throws the sock in the air.
Okay.
They did it better in the movie.
I agree.
I do think that the movie fixes this.
I think because they realize like if somebody sees this, this is going to look insane.
Well, not even if that, but like it just seems too convenient. So he happens to throw a sock in the air and Dobby caught it. So he's free. Meanwhile, in the movie, the sock is inside the diary.
Yeah.
He gives it to Dobby.
It
he's
seems
active. Like it's more
unintentional.
Well, it's unintentional.
And it's a trick.
But it's, you know, here. This is for you, Dobby.
Just like hold this.
Yeah.
Not just like, well, I just tossed this sock up in the air and Dobby happened to grab it. And
yeah.
So,
can you just never throw things into your hamper near a house elf?
And like, I just like can't believe that, like, even if Harry was handing him the book and like the book was still there, but the sock was on top. Like, why Malfoy would even touch it? I would be like, no, thank you. Like,
I don't
like,
want
go
this.
Go back to, like...
I don't want your laundry.
Yeah. Yeah, like, go back to preschool. Like, you little 12-year-old, like, child. Like, go take a bath. I don't
Maybe
know.
Maybe he thought it was supposed to be like, here's what you deserve. This dirty, slimy sock. And Lucius was just like, ugh, I don't accept your little dig. I'm going to throw it up in the air. I don't know. It's a very weird scene.
Maybe.
I'm going to choose to just believe that the movie version is what happens here.
Yes. That's what I was thinking when I was reading it. I was like confused. I was like, what? Like, I was like, I'll just pretend that it's exactly as it plays out in the movie.
Yeah. But Dobby, I don't know, catches the sock or picks it up off the ground or something. And he's like, well, this is it. I'm free now. I got this slimy sock.
Well, he didn't pick it up off the ground. He catches it.
Okay.
So he says, like, you threw a sock and I caught it. Let's see. What's the actual line? Master threw it and Dobby caught it. Dobby is free.
So then what if you throw away an old pair of pants that has holes in it?
Make sure it hits
it,
the ground first, I guess.
And yeah, like, I guess your house elf can't clean up your used... ragged clothing, like, because then they're free.
We talked about this briefly when we first talked about Dobby.
I think that we said it might be the intent.
But this kind of cancels it out.
Right. This undercuts it, because I think the argument that we made was that I am giving, so like with laundry, we talked about it. I think that what we landed on was that when you are putting laundry in a hamper or throwing it on the floor or whatever, you're intending that laundry to be washed by the house elf. You're not intending to gift it to the house elf as in, this is yours now. You're like loaning
you want it back.
Yes, exactly. Whereas, but now he's just tossing it.
This is like, I don't want this.
Maybe. Like, this does not belong to me.
Yeah.
So it's up for grabs.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
true. I don't know. I don't know.
I definitely prefer
the movie
the movie version better. And there's not a lot of times where that's the case. There's
I don't say the movie is better often.
There's going to be one that I can think of in the second to last movie that I definitely prefer, but we've got a while to go.
Yeah. So Dobby is freed in this scene by this weird mechanism, and Dobby and Harry have a bit of a chat, and Dobby said a while ago that the things happening at Hogwarts had nothing to do with He Who Must Not Be Named. And Dobby claims this was a clue because Voldemort was operating under a different name. This is a terrible clue.
That made no
clue.
Sense to me.
Right?
Yeah.
So
who could put this together?
We know through everything that Dobby's done that he's terrible at this.
Yes.
So this isn't a surprise to me.
What a, like, it's a bad cerebral clue. Oh, it's crazy. We do get Harry, though, asking Dobby to never try to save his life again, which is fun.
Totally justified.
Yeah. I did like that. And Dobby gives it to Lucius, too. He's like, I'm not yours anymore. You have no power over me. I've got power over you. And he, like, threatens Lucius.
Oh, I highlighted because you made a thing about fingers the other time.
The long fingers.
Long fingers. Yeah. So Dobby raised long a long, threatening finger.
Yeah. Dobby is powerful because he has long fingers. The magic lives in his fingers.
I still think it's a very weird thing to focus on.
Okay. I didn't write the books.
I did. No, just
Hatsune
kidding.
Miku did.
It was me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Dobby has long fingers. But it's cool to see Dobby, like, immediately stand up to Lucius. It's nice to see him kind of vindicated like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that all happens. Hermione is awoken by the mandrake juice. I want to know how Madame Pomfrey administered the mandrake drought to Nearly Headless Nick. Because we've established that ghosts can't eat.
So is it a potion that you drink?
That's what I thought. It's a drought, right?
I feel like that just means it's a liquid.
Yeah. Okay. What else would you do with the liquid?
I don't know, just like...
To administer it.
Spray it at him.
I mean, she gets a little spray
maybe
bottle.
It works both ways.
Thinking of how hard it was for Harry to get a crumpled piece of paper out of Hermione's hand, she's not easily moving their...
I guess. You would need like a functioning
epiglottis. She's not easily opening their mouths.
Yeah. Let's Google it. Mandrake. The mandrake draught is a potion. There are no details... about it, but the Harry Potter lexicon has a bullet point that says there has been some discussion as to how petrified people would be able to drink a potion. Clearly, this particular concoction is not always ingested. Perhaps Madame Pomfrey applied the potion to the skin of the victims. So I guess that can work, but that still doesn't answer Nearly Headless Nick. I guess maybe she just like waved it around inside of him, like how they fly through the food to get a little taste of it.
Mm-hmm. Or almost a taste.
Yeah. So maybe that's how it works. That is confusing, though. But Hermione and all the other petrified students and cats are... they're one and the same. are woken up and they announce at the feast that all exams are canceled as a treat. But they weren't going to be before. Like, there was discussion to the point of, we're not canceling exams through this whole thing. And it's only after they defeat the evil that the exams are canceled.
Yeah, if the danger is still there, we're taking a test.
This is wild to me. It does.
It is very weird.
It works around that whole problem of like, how can you expect somebody who's been petrified since Christmas to take an exam? But, whoo.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I had a problem with that.
Agree.
And that's all I really have about Hogwarts. They have this nice big feast. Hagrid is released from Azkaban and comes back. He's very emotional about the whole thing.
I'm about to have a nice big feast.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds nice. Yeah, and that's all I have while they're still at Hogwarts.
Well, right after the exams being canceled announcement, it's also announced that Professor Lockhart would not be able to return.
Oh, and everybody's cheering, including the professors.
Yeah, the teachers are cheering for that one. God.
Yeah.
And then Ron says he was starting to grow on me.
I mean, now that he's not himself anymore, sure.
Yeah, Ron was having a little bit of fun babysitting this, like, man-child.
Yeah. So they go off into the Hogwarts Express, and there's a very nice scene here. They all get in a compartment together, Harry, Ron, Hermione, Ginny, Fred, and George. And they play Exploding Snap and they have fun together. And it's very cute. Yeah. I love this idea of them all hanging out.
And they practice disarming each other.
Yes.
Harry is getting very good at the Expelliarmus spell.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And then they ask Ginny, what was the secret you had about Percy? Now that we know that Percy is not the heir of Slytherin. And she tells them that it's that Percy has a girlfriend named Penelope Clearwater, who was the student who was found petrified with Hermione.
Yes, this was the prefect that Harry and Ron
ran into
while they were Crab and Goyle.
Yeah, which works well because Percy was patrolling that corridor. So it would make sense that Penelope was hanging them. Out.
They see him not very long after.
Yeah. I do have two quick notes about Penelope. Original printings of Chamber of Secrets described Penelope as a fifth year, which would make her a year younger than Percy. They corrected it in 2004 and made her a sixth year. That doesn't have any kind of importance, but thought I'd note it. As far as her name, I'd like to read a little bit from the Harry Potter lexicon. In the Odyssey, Penelope was the wife of Odysseus, who very cleverly managed to avoid being forced to remarry during his long absence. Consequently, the poetic sense of the name is that of a faithful, clever woman, particularly a wife, and of a woman who is good at stringing suitors along without committing to anything. Is Percy Odysseus or is he one of the suitors?
I don't think he's Odysseus.
I don't think he's Odysseus either. Yeah, but that's all I really got about Penelope. She's not really an interesting character, but she's there. Percy's got a girlfriend.
Yes.
I don't understand why this
are gearing up to make fun of him.
And I guess that's why Percy hid it. But I don't understand why this was such a scandal.
It wasn't. It was just like a red herring throughout the movie.
Sure.
The book. It was a red herring throughout the book. And
that is something.
It's interesting to go back and see all the breadcrumbs that are left for this.
Yeah. Go on, Becca.
Yeah. I feel like it is something for siblings to make fun of their siblings for having a crush or.
I guess.
Partner, whatever.
But I don't know. I was going to say they're older.
But
yeah, he's 17.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's 16, yeah. I think. He's a sixth year.
He's a sixth year.
Yeah.
Your first year is at 11. Oh, no, you're right.
Yeah.
He's 17.
16.
16. He's 16.
I don't know. I feel like we didn't make fun of each other.
What?
Did we? Oh, yes. I guess when we were kids.
Oh, we definitely did. And about that, too.
I guess.
Yes.
Clearly, it didn't psychologically scar me as it
did. Okay, good.
Let's see. And then there's the telephone thing. So Harry tells Ron.
Oh, my God.
He gives the Dursley's phone number to Ron and Hermione and says, I taught Arthur Weasley how to use a telephone last summer. So, Ron, call me. Because obviously you'll know how, which is a very optimistic assumption.
Oh my God.
Well, not that Ron knows how, it's that his father
knows
how.
Your dad will show you.
Yeah.
I think Harry's being optimistic and assuming that Mr. Weasley grasped this.
Well, I think he spent a lot of time there over the summer. I think he made sure that Arthur could use the telephone.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a little bit of a side note, but I'm surprised Hermione never called him in the beginning of this book when he wasn't getting any letters. Like, I'm surprised they wouldn't have exchanged phone numbers, with Hermione being from a Muggle family. Clearly, she would know how to use a phone.
And Hermione lives off just the grid.
No, I think the reasoning behind Harry not giving out his phone number was because it's the Dursleys' phone number. He didn't want to deal with those repercussions. Somebody from your magic school is calling here.
Couldn't he call Hermione, like, stay up late one night after everybody goes to sleep and then call Hermione and be like, you didn't write me any letters? I guess just call her something.
I think that is definitely a possibility. I think that Harry's mindset is probably, I have an owl. I don't need to stay up late and make secret phone calls. And because that would also require Hermione to pick up the phone in the middle of the night.
Yeah. And he doesn't realize it's not. Yeah. That his letters are being intercepted. It's not that they.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't. Yeah. He didn't know everything was going to go wrong. He left that summer thinking, you know, this is going to be great. I'm going to get to write a bunch of letters to my friends.
Yeah.
It's all going to be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Joe is right that he does this because he's like, hey, owls are not a flawless means of communication. We should have a backup.
Yeah. So that's the other thing, though. Like, they should have a backup, and phones are very easy to use. It's not that hard. And I get what you were saying before about how, like, if you can't see how something works, how something thinks, don't trust it. And maybe that applies to, like, the pure blood wizarding families, but you guys were saying, I think in a previous episode, how there's not that many of them anymore. Right. And it just seems like this, like, willful ignorance of modern technology, at a certain point, I don't find it cute or endearing. It just is, like, ridiculous.
It's not cute or endearing, because a lot of situations could, like this whole owl situation, like, could easily be resolved by just using technology. And you're right that it doesn't make sense, because there's only a handful of pureblood families, whereas there have been other families that, like, who's it? Seamus has a Muggle mother his mother's a witch and his dad's a Muggle.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would have to assume that his dad wouldn't just give up using the telephone now that he's part of the wizarding community. So, like, somebody like Seamus should know how to use the telephone. We have to assume.
He definitely does. But this is well before, like, cell phones or
That's
anything.
True.
So this is strictly,
you have one landline in the house.
And Vernon needs that to sell his drills.
God, a drill salesman is still the craziest occupation one can have. But, like, you have one drill. I don't know. Maybe people have multiple drills. Like, you buy a drill once, and then maybe it breaks 10 years down the line. But, like, it's not a hopping industry, I can't imagine. Anyway, no, but this isn't the only example of, like, a technology that they should adapt. And it's weird, the ones that they do choose to take, because, like, Mr. Weasley has the car, and there's another vehicle later that's been just, like, accepted into the magical community. So, like, there's no hard and fast lines about, like, what they're willing to use and what they're not. Because, like, Mrs. Weasley has a radio. It's just, it's very odd.
Yeah.
And it is kind of posed to us of this, like, oh, aren't the wizards so quirky? Like, isn't it so weird that, like, Mr. Weasley is fascinated with all this Muggle technology but doesn't really understand it? And it just, like, other wizards would be using this stuff, or at least other people within the wizarding community, like Seamus, that, like, why wouldn't he be like, hey, my pureblood buddy, I want to call you over the summer. Can you get a telephone?
Yeah.
There's also the potential that
it's just,
like, putting down a landline to a wizard house, you would have to get Muggles to do that. You'd have to hide a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
Because I kind of got the sense that Seamus lives in the Muggle world, maybe, or somebody like Seamus. There are plenty of possibilities, but, like, they might still live among the Muggles.
They might, but if they moved into
the wizarding community,
that might be a limiting factor. They would have to get a lot of Muggles to come in and just, like, put landlines to a lot of houses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, but also, I'm going to try not to use spoilers again here, but, like, we see later in the series where they do have to, I mean, we even saw it when Hagrid took Harry to Diagon Alley and they were in London and Harry's like, oh, can we get all this stuff in London? Like, they have to know how to function and navigate a Muggle society. I mean, they're still a very small minority. Like,
that is true. And, like, I guess the argument could be made for the Weasleys that they are a pureblood family that live in like the wizarding world.
Yeah. And they're like a distant farm.
Yeah. Their only exposure to the Muggle world is the few times a year that they go into London to go to Diagon Alley. But even then, they use flu powder and go directly there. Not a lot of people, I imagine, in the Weasley situation would do that. Like go through the Leaky Cauldron into like go through proper London to get there. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of them can be totally isolated.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're right that it is a willful thing that they're doing. That, like, the Weasleys are a weird case because Arthur is trying to use all this Muggle technology.
But that's the thing. He is weird for trying to use this Muggle technology.
Yeah, yeah. I think that it is very much their, like, separation point of, like, this is a Muggle thing and how could Muggles make something better than what we can do with magic?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the other thing. There's a lot of stuff they just didn't have a need for.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. So they give them the telephone number and that's kind of just how it ends. Like they go off and into the sunset. Yeah, that's like the end of the book. I like this book.
Me too.
We don't get a lot of Hermione waking up and getting caught up.
Like
on
Hermione's
stuff.
Back and it's just like, oh, yeah, Hermione was there.
Yeah. I mean, you can assume that they filled her in on everything that happened, but I feel like they could have given her... there's not much to do. This was just like the, let's wrap everything up. Yeah. Hermione's safe.
Yeah.
But
there is a really good scene in the movie when they announce that the exams are canceled. Tiny little Emma Watson makes a face like, what?
Yeah.
Maybe that's from the first movie. I'm not sure, but it's
Hold on one second.
Actually, I think it is.
It might be from the first one.
Well... Professor McGonagall standing up to tell them all the exams have been canceled as a school treat. Oh, no, said Hermione.
As if she's been like studying this whole time. I like to think that
she woke
was
up and
unpetrified, was like, did they save the basilisk? And then was like, I need to go to the library.
Did they save the basilisk?
Did they stop the basilisk? That's what I meant to say. You know, I'll edit it. I'll fix it in post.
Yeah.
I'll just use that voice synthesizer I've been working on. Yes. So that is how the book ends. I hesitate to say that this book is like it's hard. I don't know that it's better than the first book. I think it's very different than the first book. That like the first book, especially in rereading it as an adult, I very much took it as steeped in this tragedy of Harry losing his parents. And that it's very much to me a book about loss, whereas I think that this one moves on to family and like societal relationships.
Okay.
I think those to me were two of the focuses, which like family is happening in the first book too, of like Harry entering this new family and becoming a part of the Weasleys. And I think that continues into this one.
Yeah, it grows stronger. Yeah, I'm trying to think of like what the overarching theme.
I mean, it's definitely they're dealing with prejudice, hatred, and I guess those are the two.
Yeah,
the
the focus is prejudice, but it almost seems like it's kind of ignored at the end.
It is.
It's thrown aside. Even Tom Riddle throws it aside.
It's not
This was just a vehicle to my hatred.
Sure. It's not something that can be just neatly wrapped up. Like, well, now the basilisk has been defeated, so there's no more like.
No, I'm not saying they like solved it, but like even the villain of this whole thing was like, I don't care about that anymore. I care about myself.
Is this book about power then? About how society stratifies certain groups and gives power to certain groups?
I mean, that's that's what racism is. It's like,
right.
I want the power.
Right.
And I hate you for potentially having the power. Or like, I'm going to hate you so you cannot get power.
Right. So, and then it works with the Voldemort thing that like all of this, and this is something we talked about last chapter, all of this was a vehicle for him to get power. That like he doesn't really care about the societal implications at the end of the day. At the end of the day, it's all about power.
Yeah.
And so Harry, he is making the choice. Because I think that's part of it, too. The line that Dumbledore says that, like, it's not our abilities, it's our choices. That, like, Harry has power, but he chooses to use it for good. Mm-hmm. Whereas Voldemort, because that kind of works with the parallel that's being drawn between Harry and Voldemort, that they're very similar. They come from very similar origins, but Voldemort chooses to use his power for the wrong reasons and to just elevate himself, whereas Harry uses his power to protect other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. We solved it. Yeah. Yeah, but I think this is a fantastic book. It's definitely one of my favorites in the series.
Yeah, it's very good.
I really like the movie.
Yeah, the movie is really good. I think that the movie is really good, and I think this is an intentional choice, but I think it's really good in that it's the last kids movie. I think that they start to shift into teen stuff, and the books themselves shift more into like YA territory.
I mean, this is the last time Harry is a kid.
Right, like, yes, he's a they're pre-teen teenagers. Right now. Yeah, they're teenagers.
They're teenagers in the next book.
Yeah, but so like where these are, the themes are like friendship, family, doing what's right. Things get muddier as the series goes on.
We'll talk about family a bit in the next book.
Oh, certainly. But it's complicated.
Yes.
In a way that it isn't in this book and in the previous book. So there's a definite shift, I think, that happens in the series after this book. And I don't think it's a bad shift. I think that it's a natural shift and one that had to happen to mature the series. But but I think this one has a special place in my heart as being the kind of young, whimsical, fun Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it is setting up these very real things.
Yeah. And like there's definitely some serious dark elements throughout it. And I think she is a much better writer in this book than the previous one.
I agree.
I think she grew a lot and she will continue to grow. But I think. But later on, she got a lot better for this book. I think later on, she just has more opportunity to go
flex
more.
It.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. All right. So does that bring us to our last Chamber of Secrets spell of the week?
No.
No?
No.
You have I'm more?
Kidding.
Okay.
yes, it does. And I chose to, once again, not talk about a spell.
Okay. I mean, hardly any are used in this chapter, so.
I wanted to focus on the Sorting Hat, which haunts Harry for the whole book.
Haunt is a strong word in a universe with ghosts. Let's pick a different one.
No, it haunts him. He's so focused on, did the Sorting Hat put me in the wrong place? And it gets nicely wrapped up at during this chapter in a way that like I couldn't have talked about it necessarily before now. The Sorting Hat originally was Godric Gryffindor's hat. It was just a hat.
Yeah.
But with all four founders, it was enchanted so that it would be able to read the minds of the students it's placed on to put them in the correct house. It uses a spell called, let's hope I'm pronouncing it right, legimency.
I'm pretty sure that's right.
Oh, legilimency.
Legilimency?
Yeah.
All right. Listeners, email in.
Yeah.
So it uses a power called legilimency to read the minds of these students. It also is able to, as we saw, spawn the, like, transport in the Sword of Gryffindor.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing it can transport in.
Oh, interesting.
Which I...
So, like, what if a great Ravenclaw?
They get nothing.
Okay.
This is Godric's hat.
Okay. Oh, yeah, I guess that tracks then.
That kind of tracks, but...
That's a very unfair advantage.
Yeah. All of the founders use their magic to create this, like, make this hat alive.
Yeah.
So for them to...
Godric was allowed to like sneak in a little bit extra.
Yeah, he just added in a little. Yeah, here's my sword.
Yeah,
anybody that needs my sword.
I mean, maybe it was just like a convenience thing that he had already enchanted the hat to be able to just get his sword whenever he needed it, so that he didn't have to carry around his sword all the time. And so when they were picking a hat, they're just like, "Well, Godric's is already pretty cool."
Maybe there's no order of operations for this.
Okay.
There's not too much to say.
Okay.
More about the Sorting Hat. It comes up with a song to sing every year. And this is a epiphany that Harry's going to learn next year because he didn't get to hear two different ones.
Oh,
Hermione
yeah.
knows this already. because she was at the sorting ceremony.
Yeah, but they missed it because of the car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he comes up with his own song each year, and sometimes it's laced with some advice. But yeah, it was made in 993.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's very old.
Yeah, with the original founders. So I guess that's why it's so tattered. But then it makes me think, did they have to charm it at all to protect it? Like,
An anti-raveling?
It's been a full thousand years. Is somebody sewing this? Is Dumbledore sewing this every year again?
No.
I don't think so.
They're using magic, probably. Yeah, I don't know. It's again, fitting in with that aesthetic of everything in the wizarding world is, like, kind of off. So, like, yeah, it's a tatty old hat, but it has these magical powers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all knowing.
Yeah.
As long as you wear it.
Yeah. Yeah. So is that the spell of the week?
That is the hat of the week.
Okay, great. We have an email to read. You can email us at owlpost@potrificustotalis.com with your thoughts and your comments and your questions. This one, so this is a real family podcast because this email comes in from our other sibling and Becca's twin, Den.
Hey, Den.
Hi.
So I'm going to read it. They said, "You've highlighted this idea a few times throughout the episodes, but I'm interested in how often Rowling assigns an undesirable trait to characters we are supposed to dislike or mistrust, particularly Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers. In Lockhart's case, he has a preoccupation with his hair and loud, colorful clothes. He uses a peacock feather quill, and his favorite color is lilac. He is written as cowardly, a bad duelist, and after his reveal to Harry and Ron in the Chamber of Secrets, he is shown to be duplicitous. I don't think it's too worthwhile to expect J.K. Rowling's early 2000s children's books to have incredibly multi-layered, complex villains. And maybe I'm reaching, but looking back on the book in your read-along, Lockhart is gay-coded. A man obsessed with light purple who theme dresses and can't stop looking in the mirror is playing into gay stereotypes. Harry doesn't like him immediately for these reasons, and that reaction is reinforced throughout the book by Lockhart's actions. Lockhart is consistently weak and inept until the point when he's revealed to be manipulative and predatory. I usually rank the Harry Potter books based on the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher. Lockhart brings great comic relief to the story, which is really needed to balance the darkness of the whodunit. Every petrification discovery is followed by a Lockhart scene, except, notably, the last petrification, Hermione.
Yeah.
Kenneth Branagh's performance in the movies is a constant delight. Representation in these books can be hard to come by, and I'm willing to take scraps.
Very.
At best, Lockhart is fun and camp, and he really seals the book as one of my favorites. At worst, he is an example of J.K.'s pattern of othering the Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers, which I'm interested to see it come into play in the next installments." Yeah, I think this is an incredibly thoughtful email.
Look at Den with the insightful questions. Meanwhile, I email, like, why does Harry have money? Like, one sentence. Like,
yeah, I do really enjoy this email. I like your emails too, Becca. Yeah, I think the first thing is that we're meant to felt like tricked by Lockhart. And I don't think that this is a good portrayal, considering the queer coded that Den is saying that Lockhart is, which I agree that Lockhart is queer coded.
Yeah.
It has not occurred to me throughout reading this book, which I guess is one of my blind spots to not see that. But I think that it villainizes queerness in a way, in a sense that it's like, you've been hiding something from us this whole time, and now you come out with it, and you're doing all this wrong and doing all this bad thing. It's a narrative that, unfortunately, a lot of queer people deal with, and it's disgusting.
I will admit that it is only occurring to me now that he's queer-coded. Like, it's very obvious now that you've said it, but it did not click for me for some reason.
So I appreciate...
I am kind of ashamed.
I appreciate it that Den brought us that perspective. And I think that, too, it's villainized in a way that we're supposed to laugh at Lockhart for having all of these qualities. And we're supposed to... It's like a threat to his masculinity at time, that we're supposed to think he's ridiculous for caring about his hair and all these things. It's just... Yeah. Yeah, Den is right that it's not good, and is I would argue then an example too of Rowling's problems with queerness, and I don't even say that in a sense of her recent comments, which we've talked about, which are disgusting. How she has this hatred towards trans people. And very much, I think, in her long explanation of her tweets, she portrays trans people in very much the same way, that they're hiding something to like get one over on people. She uses that ridiculous example of like trans people shouldn't be in the bathrooms for cisgender people because they might assault people, which is such a ridiculous argument and not one that I want to give too much credibility, but I think that it is mirrored in this with Lockhart, that like they're hiding something. They have malicious intent and they're using this cover, sort of. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And so that is incredibly problematic. And then also just Rowling's problems with queerness being that there are almost no queer characters in these books. It's totally unacceptable. And so for the one maybe example of a character that has qualities that we normally associate with queerness, to be not a villain, but like maybe a sub boss.
Boss is a strong word.
I mean, in a video game sense. You know?
No, yeah. I know, but like, would you even give him that?
Not really.
He throughout the books to me was just, you know, a comedic, like comic relief, like,
and then
said,
like a threat in the last like 2 seconds.
For such a short time,
yeah,
kind of a threat.
Yeah. So I think this is a great email for that analysis. And I do find it interesting, too, that they pointed out the othering of Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers, because the next two, at least, I can think of very easy ways that we can and will talk about that. I'm not sure about Quirrell in that sense. We talked about him as a victim of bullying, but I don't know.
I mean, he's othered in his like extreme anxiety,
I guess.
And
he has
being
the stutter,
possessed by
too.
Stutter, yeah. Being possessed by Voldemort.
Yeah. So I think that is an interesting pattern that we'll have to pay more attention to and talk more about.
Yeah.
So thank you, Den, for this phenomenal email.
Did we answer it?
I don't think it was so much a question as an observation. There's no question marks in it. So thank you, Den, for that email. I definitely encourage them to send us more emails and everyone to send us more emails to Owlpost.
I would agree with Den that I do like Lockhart a lot.
I like him too. And maybe that's a way that we have to have these conversations about the book and have these critical elements, but I think that we can also the Gaily Prophet, another Harry Potter podcast, phrased it in a way that I like, which is queer the fandom, queer the books. And I think that it's a way of reclaiming these characters and still grappling with the problematic elements of Rowling's writing, but also looking at them and finding our own commentary to add into there and our own nuance by taking the canon into our own hands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would say that I agreed with like Ron's opinion of Lockhart. Like, he's such a good character to hate. He's such a good, like, hateable character in the beginning, and then I, you know, love him as soon as he loses his memory.
Okay. Maybe because he's been kind of like defanged at that point.
Because like what grated me was the like he's constantly mansplaining everything to literally everyone.
Yeah.
And that bothered me the whole movie. And just like how that bothered me the whole book. And so much of his character is just about that, of like trying to one up everyone, you know, talk down to people.
Yeah. So now that we've taken that away,
and like, oh man, he's adorable. Yeah. I like him a lot.
Yeah. And I think that's a way of kind of reclaiming those gay stereotypes, that like Rowling is portraying these things as something indicative of vanity, that like, oh, men shouldn't care about their appearance, they shouldn't care about their hair, and we can take that and say like, no, it's okay for men to be that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And love Lockhart, not because we like laughing at those things, but because we genuinely like him on his merits, the good parts of him. Not the cursing people and hurting children thing.
Yeah.
So thank you again, Den. Y'all listeners and Den and Becca can send us emails to owlpost@patrificustotalis.com. There is also a way to do that through our website. You just go to patrificustotalis.com and hit the email us button. There are also buttons on there to subscribe to the show. You can listen to the show on there, find detailed show notes with references to everything that we've spoken about and referred to. And yeah, you can find us on Twitter @Podtrificus and follow us there. You can review us on any of the podcast review platforms. Honestly, I'm happy to get it anywhere. Becca, thank you so much for joining us and sitting down to talk about Harry Potter with us.
Thanks for letting me sit here and not do much talking.
You did plenty. I am happy to have you, and I hope that you will join us again and continue talking to us about Harry Potter.
Yeah. Sorry, to be on. Yeah, I'm sure I will at some point.
Yeah, yeah. Great. I would ask if you wanted to plug anything, but usually like our
Not
guests
really.
Have podcasts of their own. But I did lend you my old audio equipment, so maybe one day we will have a podcast for you to plug. yeah, and you can join us next time. Or we should talk a little bit about our plans for Prisoner of Azkaban. Maybe that was something that was written on my notes. I handed them over to Joe for him to look at something. We don't have any concrete plans for Prisoner of Azkaban.
Nothing written here.
There's a bullet point that says talk about Prisoner of Azkaban or something
this
like that.
This just says POA plans.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to write full things out on my notes.
No, I know, but like you don't have plans written down. You just have
well, because we POA don't have plans yet. We need to take a little time about our Prisoner of Azkaban plans. As with the gap between Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets, there might be a little bit of time. We haven't totally decided what we're going to do as far as release, just because we like to bank episodes, but the summer is a good time for us to bank episodes. So yeah, we'll figure that out. There might be a bit of a gap, but we're hoping it won't be too long. We are hoping to have more guests on, including some returning guests. And yeah, so you can join us next time, whenever that'll be, for Chapter 1 of Prisoner of Azkaban.
Owl Post.